Hello friends, happy new year to each and every one of you. I hope that you've had a fine festive season, that you're carrying that celebratory mood into the first few weeks of 2022, and that your fridges are still full of leftover cheese that you get to nibble on to combat the nonsense of New Year's resolutions. I'm just here to welcome you to our new year of podcasting. As Barry noted on our Twitter feed last night, it is the fifth anniversary of our first ever episode, which is bonkers and delightful. I feel like we're marking a new milestone every couple of months. But once again, thanks for sticking with us. Thanks for being such kind, warm, generous, daft, supportive fans. And if you enjoy the show, please do spread the word. A wee shout out to two listeners. Hello to Brian Stanley in County Tipperary in Ireland, who sent us his now traditional Christmas Day selfie of him looking after his livestock whilst listening to the podcast. And hello also to Jacob Faber over in Budapest, who took the podcast for a Christmas Eve walk, sent us a lovely selfie and a cracking suggestion for a topic as well. So yeah, that was delightful. Listen, we've made it as a festive thing, but let's make it a 2022 thing. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, particularly in unusual places, then do send us a selfie of yourself doing so. Two other things before we get in. One, it wouldn't be worse for Ford if there wasn't some sort of clownish uselessness on my part on the tech department. So you will notice the first 10 minutes or so, my audio is a little bit crackly and poor quality because I forgot to turn on my recorder. So you're enjoying the backup recording of myself. And the second thing, as I just alluded to a minute or so before, as a New Year's resolution, if you'd like to be kind, warm, helpful and supportive of this podcast and help it grow and reach new audiences still, why not think about giving us a review on your podcatcher of choice or recommending us via mouth or the written word to a friend? I know it seems like podcasters who are now seasoned and veterans like us go on and on and on about such things, but it really is the lifeblood of podcasting. So if you want to do one lovely thing for us this year, please do that. I will also mention that Omicron notwithstanding, we're going to be doing our next live show in our biggest ever room in 7 weeks' time. I'll be honest, I know it's in February. I think it's the 20th. I have forgotten the details, but it's the third or fourth Sunday in February, and it's at 2:30 p.m. And my God, you've got to buy tickets. The link is in the show notes of this podcast. So once again, if you live within a 3-hour train journey or indeed EasyJet flight of London, it is your moral duty to attend the show. Do get a negative lateral flow first. That is all. Now it's just time for you to do what I'm doing and actually try and flush away that naughty cheese, meat and wine that you've been enjoying over the festive period with some vegetables. But by the end of this episode, you'll know which one is best to avoid. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. Now this week, we're talking about the world's worst vegetable, and with a show title like that, I know listeners, you and indeed Ben, are probably expecting me as host to use my introduction to go on some sort of long-winded pun run, where I say things like, this week we're going to be upfront, honest and straight as a marrow with you, as we have always been, and we'll avoid any corny jokes, and so on. You'll probably even think I'd be so daring as to wrangle a tortured setup involving owning a sheepdog who wears roses in its fur, just so I could say the word cauliflower. But no, I want you to know that I'm trying to give up puns for Christmas, and this is actually really hard for me, and my eyes are twitching, and my chest is tensing, and I'm trying to hold them in even as we speak. A going cold turkey is never the best option. Now I've said turkey, I'm imagining Brussels sprouts, and I'm trying to find a way of working the word Belgium into the next sentence. So to save me from myself, please welcome the man who's always rooting for me. Oh God, I said root and now I'm thinking about beetroot. Rescue me, Ben van der Velde.
Well, you squashed an awful lot into that, didn't you? You massive fucking turnip.
Genuinely, the original first draft of that intro was about 12 pages long, Ben. There are so many vegetables, and I could not... I just had to be harsh with myself.
Well done. Well, I'm glad you managed to top and tail that and then peel its skin off. You did very well indeed. Did you, since this is currently a lot of my life, when you were a child... Did you eat your vegetables like a good boy?
I was a very good boy and ate my vegetables, but myself and my younger brother had a very different opinions about what vegetables we like. So I didn't like sweet corn and he didn't like peas. So I would have peas and he would have sweet corn when that was, you know, tinned, obviously. So yeah. One, a tin of each for both of us. And then I also struggled with the taste of some of the like vegetables, the good vegetables you're meant to be eating. So I used to put vinegar on turnip to make it more palatable and ketchup on cabbage, which... I don't know why I thought that made it taste better, because now I think of it, the idea of ketchup and cabbage
That's
makes
awful.
Me want to retch.
I like the fact that your family is so Irish that rather that they had to be divided about something, it couldn't be religion, it couldn't be land, so instead it was peas versus sweet corn. That was the sectarian division within your household.
Yeah, what's the traditional Jewish vegetables of choice in the van der Velde house?
I mean, if it's the traditional Jewish vegetables, it is it's red cabbage.
Which I don't really like.
It took me a long while to get into it, but I say it's nice, sort of like with apple and currants and sugar. And I guess you could add walnuts to it as well, but that's a bit too exotic for my dad.
Do you know what I love about that, though, is that clearly people have got red cabbage taste. We have to add all of this stuff to it to make it bearable. I'm sort of quite glad that we've reached the stage now where, certainly in Ireland, obviously there were a lot of great economic advances around the time of the early 90s, and people talk about the Celtic Tiger and, you know, the impact of Ireland competing at the 1990 World Cup and how it sort of changed the face of the nation. I'm also just glad that... Because we've returned from a net emigration to a net immigration, we've had people come in and teach us how to do vegetables one way other than boiling.
Yeah.
That's been one of the great advantages of the last 40 years of progress.
Well, I feel like, with the greatest respect to my parents, I have had to escape from a gastronomic yoke, which has not been eggy. But just, you know, my dad went to boarding school in the 1950s. So again, anything other than boiling a vegetable that is anything other than white is unacceptable to him. And my mum cooks a good roast chicken and an average everything else. And you said it last week. Glad that my wife's not on social media. Oh, God, my mum is on social media, mostly in a surveillance position. But she doesn't listen to the podcast, so I think we're all right. But my favourite vegetable when I was growing up was sprouts. Loved a good sprout. And then I became a bad Jew and discovered that you can have them with bacon and they got even better. But I liked sprouts so much that when we used to go to some of my parents' friends' house for Friday night dinner, everyone else would get Friday night dinner and his waggish friend Anthony would give me a bowl of sprouts. Joke's on him, though. He got to enjoy 9-year-old kosher farts. But before I reveal any more of the wayward tales of my Just William, Just Schmillion Jewish childhood, we should meet this week's guest. And our guest this week is an American comedian living in Britain who has won awards in Australia. Make of that what you will. She has created shows exploring the world of dating, evolution, and decision-making, which means I assume that her partner has been carefully selected from a cast of millions. While she is not putting her scientific background to excellent comedic use, she is touring all over the United Kingdom, hosting and performing at some of the top comedy clubs. She also, like me, runs one of London's most loved independent comedy clubs. And while mine, Good Shit Comedy, takes care of the North, she makes sure that Laugh Train Home has the South rolling in the aisles in Honor Oak and in Battersea. She is the southern Perky to my northern Pinky. It is a delight to welcome Robin Perkins.
Hi, thank you so much. That was a great intro. Thank you. You made me sound wonderful. It's really great to be here.
That's my job. You're very welcome here. What is your favorite vegetable, since we're about to slag it off?
My favorite, not my least favorite.
No, because if you said your least favorite now, I'd be like, bye, yes, see you later, podcast listeners. So,
I know, I
we've got it. You've got to eat your nice vegetables before we get to the bad vegetables.
True. I'll give some mentions. My partner loves cabbage. That's her favorite, which I find odd, like absolutely hands down favorite.
No one's favorite is cabbage.
She boils it to the end of its life. I think I have a very weird top two. I would say aubergine. Or eggplant, if anybody's listening in the States. You have to translate. Love it.
It's got to be charred. It's got to have that nice, like, burnt.
I can do aubergine anyway. Like, sorry, that sounded very...
yeah, 1,000 emojis just sat up and paid attention.
Exactly. Anyway, you say? Anyway. Yeah. Like, but any, like, mashed, grilled, charred, like, in a... you cook it and then mash it with like good spices and stuff.
One of those ones where you go, you make it not in any way resemble the thing it is, put lots of other flavors on it, and then it's acceptable?
No, I just a little bit of fenugreek and like some cumin, and I cook a lot. I love
it. No, that's good. Listen, for me, the only acceptable type of artichoke is... excuse me, not artichoke. The only acceptable sort of aubergine is an artichoke. No, the only acceptable sort of aubergine, and I can't quite remember the specific name of them, is basically the tiny, tiny baby aubergines that are in Thai curries, which are pea aubergines. That's what they're called. They are phenomenal.
Oh my God. I don't even know the best way. I mean, Thai food is my favorite food anyway, but you get like a miso kind of teriyaki braised aubergine, which is incredible. I love it. I love aubergine. I think that and tomatoes, which I know technically tomato is a fruit. I understand that. I get that. I accept that. However, it identifies as a...
Oh, yes, you're right. The trans community needs to take tomatoes as their fruit/vegetable of choice.
Absolutely.
I don't know, are tomatoes trans or are tomatoes non-binary? Or are they gender fluid?
Maybe gender fluid. Yeah. I mean, because if you think about, like, scientifically a fruit identifying as a vegetable, I don't know, but I'm in love with them. I mean, again, so versatile. I mean, I sun dry my own tomatoes usually in the oven because you get a better flavor. Don't buy
excuse me. No, you don't sun dry things in the oven.
I oven dry my
Thank
tomatoes.
You.
I get that. Fine.
Robin has the power to control the sun itself.
I rein it in. It's like my superpower. Yes. I'm like,
marvelous. Question number two, which we always ask our guests, is what is it that you're worst at in the world? You're clearly a brilliant cook. Oh, well, or at least you talk a good culinary game. What are you worst at in the world?
I am the worst at jumping. Like, I don't know if it's my hamstrings don't exist or they're just not good, but it's a shame that this is just audio, because next time I see you, I will jump, because you'll be like, there's no way that is as high as you can jump. But it's like, I can't jump off the ground. I've done it on stage. It's that horrible that I'm like, no. Let me try to jump, and then I just put all of my effort, and I get about that far off the stage, and I don't know why.
Is it, you know, when people say, people say jump, and I say how high? With Robin, people say jump, and Robin says how?
Yep, that good. I mean, I just, I realize I'm hypermobile, so my joints are all weird anyway. And so I could never run fast either. So I always did water sports as well.
Oh, wow.
Water polo, swimming.
I mean, now I want to see you attempt the triple jump.
Do you want me to jump? I can. No, no, I mean, I could do it.
No, but I think
the question is, can you hop and skip as well?
Yeah.
No.
So it would basically just be like... Like, not running followed by a stutter.
Yeah. Like, if you were ever like, Robin, come on, like, get run to the car, we're late. And I'd be like, I am. It's really bad. It's comical. Yeah.
Are you good at falling down?
Oh, so much. So much.
Good.
Ben will know this. I've had about 4 or 5 ankle surgeries in the last 5 years. I actually am such a regular at the ankle surgery in the hospital. The last one that I got was November a year ago. And I went in and the anesthetist remembered me and was like, hey, how's it going? How's comedy? Like, it is.
You get this neck surgery free.
Yeah. it's why I moved here, actually. It's just so many surgeries, such a low bill. I fall over a lot.
You very much belong on this podcast then. And we should welcome the fourth member of this podcast, because this week's is a Patreon episode, and a Patreon episode for a noble human who is donating £10 a month to the cause, and so gets to sit in judgment upon the show. And joining us in full gown and wig is a gentleman born in Windsor who lives in Berlin, works for a pharmaceutical company, but one of the good guys apparently, and also does trapeze in his spare time. And I'm going to say that that is someone who has just picked a bunch of disparate facts out of a sack to create a life. Because how many other Berlin-based pharmaceutical trapeze artists have you ever met? It is a delight to meet the lovely Jack O'Reilly. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for that.
You're very welcome.
Berlin pharmaceuticals rep / trapeze artist sounds like a cover story that George Smiley rejected.
I'm not sure the Venn diagram between the two, but I've not met any others that are in both industries, I guess. Circus performers.
Yeah. Both of you can get you high.
Yeah, both get you high.
Yeah, well, luckily for you, your Venn diagram has so many crisscrosses in it, it looks like a safety net, which I suppose is what you need as a trapeze artist. And obviously, you can't see that, but we're looking into Jack's bedroom or living room, and behind him, Jack has got a stepladder with a vase on top of it, because not only does he like to be put in mortal danger with his hobbies, he likes all of his decor to be right on the edge.
Yeah, especially with 2 cats in the household as well, so that's...
Oh, mate! I mean, you do have room to swing a cat, but you should not.
Yeah.
First of all, we've already mentioned the tomato and its confused identity. Let's make things even more confusing. So the tomato, among a number of animals, like the aubergine as well, is part of the Solanaceae family, or as better known to you and me, nightshade. So tomatoes and potatoes and things like that are related to deadly nightshade. And because of that, one can graft a tomato plant onto a potato plant to make a pomato, which...
Or a tomato.
Or a tomato. Yeah. Do you know what we found is that song could just have been condensed down into one verse, couldn't it?
Yes.
Just wasting our time, Cole Porter. Is it Cole Porter? It's probably Cole Porter.
It sounds like Cole Porter.
it's either Cole Porter or Irving Berlin. It's one of those two lads, isn't it? This has been done as early as the 19th century, and I didn't realise there are various different pieces of vegetation you can do with this with. Apparently, there is a popularity for growing things called fruit salad trees, which is a single tree producing different types of citrus fruit.
What?
Yeah. Or you can create a tree that creates a variety of fruit with stones, so peaches and plums and apricots and things like that. And it is a useful thing. So it's been used in developing world countries like Kenya to help farmers save space on time and labour without affecting the quality of their produce.
It's like a little sort of supermarket.
Yeah.
Nature's supermarket.
Ugh.
All the things you could want under one roof.
Yeah, yeah. It's been sold in the United Kingdom since September 2013 via a horticultural mail order company. And I'm going to say buying plants by mail order doesn't fill me with confidence. And this was Thompson and Morgan, who sold pre-grafted plants branded as the Tomtato. To be fair, You can order certain plants pre-grafted, but they are currently still illegal in this country.
In Britain?
Yeah.
Right,
sorry.
Why?
Oh, no. Certain other plants that you can buy pre-grafted are illegal in this country.
Oh, I see.
Yes. So, obviously, having looked at the tomtato and the pomato, I then looked at the most famous potato in history, which is...
The King Edward?
No.
Mars Piper?
No. Mr. Potato Head. So, Mr. Potato Head was created in the early 1940s by a toy inventor in Brooklyn called George Lerner. It's speculated he got the idea from watching his nephew placing sticks inside potatoes in the family garden. And what Lerner would do, he'd often take potatoes from his mother's garden and use other fruits and vegetables as facial features. Now, brilliantly, Mr. Potato Head was quite a controversial toy at the time because of rationing within recent memory. So using fruits and vegetables for this frivolous toy was considered genuinely distasteful.
Or tasty.
Or tasty, yeah. But he managed to get the idea up and running by the early 1950s when it was spotted by Henry and Merrill Hassenfield. You guys will know them as the Hassenfield brothers, or Hasbro. They realised it was unlike anything they had, and they paid the cereal company, who had bought Lerner's idea for $5,000, they paid them $2,000 to stop production, a further $5,000 for the rights, and Lerner was offered an advance of $500 and a 5% royalty on every Mr. Potato Head kit sold. So,
whew, that's a good deal.
Right. And Mr. Potato Head went in production on May the 1st, 1952. He also became the first toy ever advertised on the television and the first ever campaign to be aimed at children.
Wow.
It was so successful that a year later, he got relations. He got Brother Spud and Sister Yam. However, by the 1960s, the controversy continued because the sharp parts had to be made blunter because children were cutting them on them, which made it harder to insert into the potato. And also, children were choking on the small pieces as well. So that is why we get the Mr. Potato Head we now know so well. Just a couple of other bits of Mr. Potato Head. Facts.
Can I just say, I just love toys in the 50s and 60s. And this was, when did you say this went on the market first?
Early 1950s.
Yep. So it took until the 1960s worth of children slicing their fingers open with these parts before they said, maybe we should blunt them.
Yeah, come on, Johnny, stop crying about having swallowed a razor blade.
Got nine other fingers, what are you crying about?
Yeah. Yeah, now you can play it being like your Uncle Jimmy, the Korean War vet. Mr. Potato Head, in 1985, entered the Guinness Book of World Records for breaking what record, my friends?
Person with the most faces in human history.
No, I'm afraid that's Boris Johnson.
Ah, yes, of course.
Jack, Robin, any ideas?
Most number of Mr. Potato Heads?
No.
Oh, like in one place, when they have gatherings like of Santas collection. And things.
Highest selling toy or something?
That's a really good shout. Now, I mean, you were never going to guess, guys. He received 4 postal votes in the run for mayor of Boise, Idaho, and so he was in the book for most votes for Mr. Potato Head in a political campaign.
Oh, I mean, I'm glad that Mr. Potato Head holds the record for the most votes for a Mr. Potato Head.
Yeah, you're right. It'd be shocking if it was Barbie.
Yeah.
My final favourite thing about them is obviously it's a toy that's been around for 70 years, so they have diversified where there's all different kinds of Mr. Potato Head. You can get Star Wars themed ones called things like Darth Tater, a Spud Trooper, or R2 Potato. There is a Transformer themed one called Optimash Prime.
No, there isn't.
An Indiana Jones themed one for Taters of the Lost Ark. But the best one, my friend, don't you cringe, Barry, you opened this podcast with a pun run. The best
I
one...
I said so much I didn't want to do them.
...is an Iron Man-themed one called Tony Starch. I think that's glorious. You're not having any of it.
Again,
I then went down an incredible wormhole where I discovered something I have never, ever heard of. And this is a popular myth from the Middle Ages about a particular vegetable called the vegetable lamb, or barometz. And barometz means lamb in the Tartar language. And it's believed that this plant grew in Tartary. And it was first brought to popular attention in the late 1300s by a chap called Sir John Mandeville, who was the pseudonym of a very, very famous Middle Ages traveller who heavily influenced the work of, Christopher Columbus, who heavily influenced the crimes of Christopher Columbus. But John Mandeville, even though he had an English name, is believed to have actually been a Frenchman, and he travelled through Turkey, Tartary, Persia, Syria, Arabia, Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia, Chaldea, Amazonia, not where you think it is, and India, obviously popping in Jerusalem on the way to say hello to the Crusaders slash the Saracens, whoever was in charge there at the time, slash the Ottomans, I imagine. The vegetable lamb is described as... It was born of melon seeds and is the fruit of a tree that would burst open when ripe and reveal a perfect imitation of a little lamb on it. And instead of a stalk, the stalk would sort of resemble an umbilical cord that would reach into the vegetable lamb's navel. And the stem was flexible enough for the suspended lamb to bend down and eat the grass around it. However, when there was no grass left, the stem would wither and the lamb would die.
And they had some sort of religious epiphanies related to this. Is this like seeing Jesus in toast, Lamb of God stuff?
Strangely not. No, it doesn't have that. I thought it would. It was just one of those, you know, when you read chronicles from travellers and it's like, oh yeah, I definitely saw a guy with three eyes in his chest. It's that sort of thing. This was debunked first by an Italian polymath called Girolamo.
You don't say.
Remember the credulousness of people in the past. He debunked it in 1557, not on the grounds of, guys, you must be fucking stupid, but that he said that soil didn't provide enough heat for the lamb to thrive, which, to be fair to him, is, you know, it's proper science. but it was still being described in 1887. There was further depth in the description by a gentleman called Henry Lee, who said that this plant slash lamb could be eaten, that its blood tastes like warm honey, and that the native people of its homeland use it to make head coverings and other articles of clothing. And it's suggested maybe that it could be people looking at fields of cotton have made them think of this plant.
Okay.
Yeah.
With like fluffy heads.
Yeah, and it also may well have a echoes in Jewish folklore. There is a creature called a Yadua, which go on.
You do or you don't.
Sure. Yeah. That is basically the Old Testament's rules and laws summed up in a sentence, isn't it?
Yeah.
You do or you don't, Shmuley. You do or you don't. So the Yadua was, again, lamb-like in form, connected to the earth on a stem, and it was harvested only by severing it from the earth with an arrow or a dart, and once you did that, you could use the animal's bones for divination. And this was going to be my choice until I found two other things. First of all, a friar called Oderic, Oderic of Pordenone, described something, was actually recalling hearing about these vegetable lambs and told of trees on the shores of the Irish Sea in Orkney with gourd-like fruits that fell into the water and became geese. And he referred to these as barnacles, which later got extended to barnacle geese, which I just find delightful.
Yeah.
But I went back...
Did he just see some geese in a tree?
Yep.
had drunk some pretty strong communion wine before seeing them.
Well, talking of wine brings me to my suggestion, and we go back to Eastern Europe. I'd like to read to you from a small interview written by Amy Fine Collins, who is a correspondent for Vanity Fair. She went back to Russia to try and discover her Jewish family's roots. And in it, she recounted a friend's trip to somewhere called Zagorsk in Russia. And she writes, "Troubled by the anti-Semitism he encountered there, my friend, Andrew Solomon, asked a local peasant why, in his estimation, there was such antipathy everywhere against the Jews. Without a moment's hesitation, the peasant answered in Russian, 'It is because the Jews have a secret vegetable they eat so they don't become alcoholics like the rest of us, and they refuse to share the vegetable with anyone else.'" Just going to let you guys, ironically, drink that in.
Yeah.
I need this vegetable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, Robin. I can't give it to you. That's literally our shtick. It's what we do.
Man, but my sister's Jewish and she's never told me.
Again, we're keeping thumb on it. But, you know, it's refreshing that the reason the Russians are apparently anti-Semitic to us is not because we killed Jesus, not because we hoard the money, not because we're secretly vermin, but because we're stopping them being immune to vodka. Apparently, this myth is traced back to a Russian folk hero called Golovan. And I believe Golovan is thwarted by a Jewish character in this folktale, but I really struggle to find much more about it. But just I couldn't not choose this vegetable because it's
a hoarded Jewish vegetable.
Yes, the hoarded Jewish vegetable that makes you impervious to alcohol is my suggestion.
For the worst.
And what's it called?
Wait, for the worst vegetable. Not the best. The worst.
Yes, for the worst, because it is a vegetable that is underpinned anti-Semitism in Russia.
Oh yeah, no, that actually.
You know, there you go. That.
No, that's fair.
Does it have a name?
No, I couldn't find a name for it. I'll keep looking. I spent a good 20 minutes searching for it, but not much could come up. Any Jewish listeners? I know we've got a few who love lobbing, who A, love lobbing folklore at us, and B, love very much getting out the red pen, circling my errors, and letting me know. If you know any more about this, please do, because I've never heard of it before. And you're right, Robin. You could flip it to be a good one, because without this vegetable underpinning anti-Semitism in Russia, would my relations have ever run away to a different part of Europe and come here?
So we've got you to thank for this vegetable.
If the vegetable didn't...
No. Yeah.
Don't you take that anti-Semitic tone of voice with me, McStay.
I feel like Ben's come up with some really interesting... I just chose a carrot.
Yeah, you're right. You're right, Robin. Fuck carrots.
Yeah, fuck those guys.
I have many reasons why I hate carrots. Apart from them being like, they're just all right. Carrots are awful. Number one, they're not good. Like, I know you're like, oh, it's lovely. It's like eating a slightly sweetened wet stick. All right, you're just eating a branch. That's what it is. If you want a sweet vegetable, you have way better options than that. Sweet potato. All right, that is similar and lovely and comes in way... You can have sweet potato fries way better than carrots. You can't fry a carrot. Mm. I mean, you can, but it's gross. All right, so...
Very true.
Point number one.
Actually, that's a good test for if a vegetable is good. Can you fry it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, nobody has fried carrots. How many carrots do you see in Scotland?
Deep fried carrots.
It's not on the menu, and it's for a reason. Yeah. All right, number two. Reason is that they turn your skin orange if you eat them too much. We're going to be delving into beta carotene in a second because I've obviously gotten into that one.
How many?
If you eat
carrots,
too much.
How much is too much?
Well, I mean, I would argue that one is too many. But I mean, you do have to eat a lot. However, and I understand that in adults, so if you eat too many carrots, they do get poisonous. They turn your skin orange, which is like great if you're an Oompa Loompa, just eat away. But like, if you It's not, but where it really comes into play is that carrots aren't really safe for babies. They've done a lot of studies where you have to give them smaller amounts of carrots because too many of them can be poisonous.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
I'm rather concerned that I've got that information now when my parenting style has been, it's orange and exciting. Feed the child the exciting, slightly sweet food.
Orange sticks. Yeah, lots of orange sticks.
I did say some studies, so I don't know how many. I don't know how many carrots. We'll just save that. I'll send you some sources afterwards, mainly Wikipedia. So,
Robin's going to stage an intervention on behalf of your children.
I know. Also, carrots change the flavor of breast milk. And while it's not my drink of choice, if you have a baby.
Does now.
How did they find this out?
Yeah.
some
babies were snitching.
I know. They had a really intense taster session.
Yeah. Here's the thing. It is a fact that certain foodstuffs can change the taste of sperm. Pineapple being the most oft-quoted example, I believe. Is carrot the only foodstuff that can change the taste of breast milk? Or are there other breast milk flavours? Like, are there strawberry, chocolate and vanilla?
I mean, it must be... Because I'm trying to think. I was going to send this podcast to my parents, but...
We'll just insert a really long beep next minute or two.
Just saying, as bisexual, there's a lot of things that can do that. I'll send you my Excel sheet later. I usually, whenever I go out on dates, there's a really
this
long
is a sliding
one. You know
scale.
How I said I did like a whole show on like the science of dating? That's involved. I'm gonna need you to fill out a diet sheet.
Okay.
But I would imagine a lot of things change the flavor of breast milk. Mm. I don't know. I don't have any kids, and I don't remember being a baby, but I imagine they do.
If you do have kids, you need to breastfeed them long enough for them to be able to talk, you to be able to conduct a scientific experiment.
I think that is the take-home message. Breastfeed your kids until they turn at least 10.
Yeah.
Ben, are you writing this down? This is ace parenting advice, all right?
I'm on it. I must breastfeed my kids until they're 10. Got it.
Yeah, exactly. you specifically.
We know... we talked about in the podcast before that carrots weren't originally orange. Which is a thing. They used to be white. Yeah.
No, they used to be purple as well, didn't they?
I think I've seen in some supermarkets you can get heirloom carrots, they call them, in different colours to make them interesting.
Yeah. There's two thoughts. Farmers started growing orange ones to distinguish them from wild ones, which would be the other colours. And also there's talk of them being a tribute to the House of Orange in the Netherlands, which may or may not be true as well. I'm disappointed that William of Orange didn't have orange skin. That if he'd been really making the effort, he would have developed carotenemia and really gone the whole way.
And this country would have been ruled by a house of Oompa Loompas.
Yes, correct. The House of Saxe, Coburg, Gotha, Oompa.
Arguably doing a better job. So
yeah.
But I believe that the orange color of the carrots comes from beta carotene. Now, this is the big orange debate, or the carrot debate, because everyone's like, oh, carrots are so healthy, right? Because they have beta carotene. Now, beta carotene turns into vitamin A, and it is good for you, but too much of it, I mean, it's great. It's an antioxidant. It protects your body from free radicals, which then, oxidation. It does help. However, two things. First of all, you don't need to eat carrots just to get beta carotene, because it's not even the vegetable with the most beta carotene. Like a half a cup of sweet potato has as much beta carotene as an entire cup of carrots. And as we've covered earlier, I think we can all agree that sweet potato tastes better than carrots. And it comes in so many different ways, like mashed and fries. And you disagree with me, Ben. I can see it on your face.
No, not at all. I just love that your approach is that carrots are a fraud.
Yes, they are. I mean, what they are is carrots were a vegetable with a better marketing strategy.
I think it's because they were. I think it's because they were cheaper, more readily available during the olden days of rationing and stuff. So it's just a cheaper way to get the beta carotene in.
great the carrots were like there through the war, but now we are in the 21st century, guys. It's all about sweet potatoes and spinach.
Yeah, but listen, no, I won't be having any of that nonsense. Like, the carrot is the most patriotic vegetable. It did its duty. When Britain called, Colin Carrot stood up.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we all need to move on, all right? We are a developing country. And we are developing the carrot. It's built on a lie, all right? Sweet potato has more beta carotene. I understand that you are, like, nostalgic about it, and that's fine. You can, like, fine, if you want to eat carrots, like, as, like, a retro thing, you know? Like, a little callback. Call back to war times. Oh, I'm having a carrot. But when your main, like, delivery is with the condiment, you're not good on your own. Carrots come with hummus. And we all know it's because hummus is better. It's a vehicle. That's what it is.
Carrots are riding on the back of chickpeas.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I will not have it. All right. Give hummus its time to shine.
Give peas a chance.
Oh my God.
I'm so sorry.
Robin, if you're eating shiny hummus, then something is very wrong with that. That needs to go in the bin.
I actually make my own hummus. All right.
Ooh.
And do you lacquer it?
I soak the chickpeas and then I boil the chickpeas and then I grind them with the ingredients I got. Yeah, it's part of.
Can I say I have never heard a more bisexual sentence than I make my own hummus?
My final point, what I will say about why carrots are the worst vegetable, is because I am allergic to them.
Are you allergic specifically to carrots, or is there, like, a family of vegetables or something in them that you're allergic to generally?
So it's related to oral allergy syndrome. So there's a bunch of things that I am allergic to, like, for example, raw potatoes. Can't peel them as well. Once they're cooked, fine, but I have to get, like, if I'm in the same room as somebody peeling potatoes, I'll start sneezing and stuff.
In the same room? Never mind.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. And I, like, somebody eating raw carrots in my presence starts making me sneeze. So, yeah, we got through the pandemic, we got a veg box, but usually you can, like, put stuff that you don't want. But during the pandemic, it was like, nah, you get what we have, which is fair. Yeah. So we get all these carrots because they're cheap and gross. And so we got them. And then Caitlin had to go to the end of the garden to eat them. So just several little carrots. But yeah, it's a celery is a big one that I'm also allergic to. But yeah, it's linked to, like, different tree pollens as well. So it's worse at different parts of the year, but they make my mouth itch, and I start sneezing. And if I just keep going with it, I'll start wheezing. So it's, yeah, not they're horrible.
Well,
to realize,
you brought
a personal
ginger, vendetta.
Being allergic to carrots is, like,
yeah,
the most ironic allergy ever. But yeah, that's it. That's why I am not a fan.
Wow. I mean, Bugs Bunny and you have a lot of talking to do. I feel like we need to lock you both in a room.
I can't wait to see the Robin versus Bugs Bunny roast battle on Comedy Central.
Yeah.
Roasted
carrots,
I mean,
are delicious, though.
I just think all of the things that people love about carrots can be done by other people, other vegetables. I think they're hype. It, like, there's a lot of lies, and I think the flavor doesn't stand up to their lack of skills. That's what it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
I you know what? I love when a guest comes on the show and goes, fuck it, I'm going to attack probably everyone's favorite vegetable. I'm going to take on the big gun. I'm going to tell you all why you're wrong.
Exactly. But I am correct here. I feel like I've got some converts. Either that or I just lost, like, 3 followers.
Well, we've also discovered what the vegan equivalent of a sacred cow is.
For me to start off, I'm going to ask you, funny enough, about what Ben just said. Are there any fruits or vegetables that aren't vegan?
Oh. Is that because of, like, there might be insects on them or involved in not manufacturing them, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, getting there.
I was
going
to say roast potatoes, like done properly, but that doesn't really count, huh?
Yes.
I'm thinking of figs, but that's a fruit, obviously.
There are some fruit on this list.
I was wondering for something similar to that. The pollination process.
Yeah. Why aren't figs?
Because for figs to be pollinated, they need to be pollinated by a certain fig wasp. And as part of the process, they lay eggs inside the actual fruit of the fig. So when you eat the fig, there's still wasp larvae and eggs inside the fig.
I really wish I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Me too.
Like, I'm not vegan. I'm just disgusted now.
Yeah. So. But more.
I had to write an essay on this part of my studies and really put me off figs.
Oh.
You wrote an essay on this? Man, you keep getting cooler.
Yeah. But yeah, Jack on his trapeze with his army of fig wasps.
Yeah.
Can I was not expecting Jack to have my fig knowledge augmented when I first started talking to you this afternoon.
Well, it's a bit similar. It's a bit similar to that. According to, I suppose, the show that inspires ours, QI on BBC TV, almonds, avocados, kiwi, butternut, squash, and melon are not vegan. It's according to Sandy Toksvig, the host of the show, it's the same reason as honey. They can't exist without bees, and bees are used in, let's call it, an unnatural way because they're so difficult to cultivate naturally. All of these crops rely on bees, which are placed on the back of trucks and taken very long distances across the country. It's migratory beekeeping and it's a natural use of animals. There are lots of foods that fall foul of this. Broccoli is another example. Cherries, cucumbers, lettuce, lots and lots of vegan things are not actually strictly vegan, according to this.
Let's call it what it is. It's not migratory beekeeping, it's bee kidnapping.
Yeah.
I think it's a bee trade. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Well, bee trafficking. Then.
Yeah, bee trafficking. Yeah. That is what it is. All right, I have a question, though. So what if you grow a butternut squash in your backyard and you don't traffic the bees? Is that vegan?
That would definitely be vegan. And in fairness, the Vegan Society disagrees with this fact on QI. They say, vegans avoid using animals as far as possible and practicable. We are aware that many forms of farming involve indirect harm to animals, but it is unfortunately not possible or practicable to avoid the destruction of other animals in most farming at this time. However, we do not consider that just because it's not possible to avoid 100% of the cruelty, suffering and exploitation to animals, that we should not bother at all. Vegans make a huge contribution to the reduction in suffering and death caused to animals, and we would welcome any changes made to farming practices that support this, which, in fairness, is quite a reasonable stance for the vegans to take.
That's not the face of veganism that I've been led to believe is the mainstream.
Yeah, it's not the fundamentalist vegan approach that we would expect.
Yeah, so I want the Westboro Baptist vegans to comment on this, please.
God hates figs. God hates figs.
It took us long enough, but we finally found a funny pun. Well done.
It wouldn't be an episode about vegetables and indeed fruit for us to play a game of, is this actually a vegetable? So, let's see, folks. Avocados.
Vegetable.
No, it's a fruit. It's a nut.
Yeah, I think it's a nut.
Ben?
I'm going to go with the prevailing wind. It's a nut.
should have gone against the wind, Ben. Avocado is a fruit. It has a three-layer pericarp surrounding its single seed. Fruits are generally sweet, vegetables are generally savoury, sort of a generic explanation. But the botanical definition of a fruit is quite specific. A fruit is a mature, ripened ovary, along with the contents of that ovary, which is a seed. Whereas vegetables are a bit more vague in definition. It's any edible part of a plant from the flower buds to the roots. And so in the case of an avocado, it's a fruit that has the exocarp, which is the peel. The mesocarp is the green flesh. And then the endocarp is a tiny, tiny little layer around the seed. So the bit in the middle, the brown bit you see, there's a tiny little layer, and then the rest of it is the seed. And because the endocarp is thin, it's also technically a berry. Fruit with thick endocarp, so quite a strong armour around the seed or pits, like a peach, for example, they're called drupes, D-R-U-P-E-S, not berries. Mm.
Hmm.
Yeah. Let's try another. Olives. Now you've got all that facts. The rest of these should be easy.
Of course. Olives. Olives are a fruit.
They are indeed. They're a drupe. They're like a peach. They've got thick endocarp around their seed. Cucumbers.
Are an alien species.
Vegetable.
Berry.
They're a fruit. They're part of the Cucurbitaceae family, like watermelons and cantaloupes, apparently. Zucchini.
That's veg.
Yeah, that's going to be veg.
Nope, it's the same as a cucumber. It's also the Cucurbitaceae.
You haven't given us a single vegetable.
Hang on, are we going to be that derivative that this podcast is going to be no such thing as a vegetable?
None of these that I'm going to give you are vegetables. The butternut squash is also a member of the Cucurbitaceae. Pumpkins are basically another fruit. They're related, and because they're like a squash, they're a surprisingly close relative of the cucumber, of course. String beans.
I'm not going to guess vegetable because you've already told me none of these are vegetables.
String beans are interesting because the full pod means they're a fruit. So if it's a bean on a pod, then that's a fruit because you've got the case with the seeds in it. But the individual beans then themselves are seeds, not fruits. And corn on the cob. Each corn kernel is an ovary that contains a single seed. So then when you have them on the cob, that's just basically a collection of these. And they're known as caryopses or grains. So a fruit can also be grain.
You know what?
But
I just had this image of like eating a corner of the cob and like just munching some ovaries. Like, I don't
just
know.
Just eating those ovaries.
Yeah, we all went to the same place there, guys. Like, would you care for some yellow barbecued ovaries covered in paprika and butter? No, I would not.
Yeah. And rhubarb is a really interesting one.
Ooh.
Rhubarb has a very fruity taste. It's used in dessert. And the fact that it's used in sweet dishes prompted a 1947 court case where it was ruled in America that rhubarb is, in fact, a fruit. Now, despite this, it is a vegetable. To be very clear, rhubarb is a vegetable. Its stems and stalks are edible, but the roots and leaves contain toxic poison. But at issue in the particular case was the fact that there were tariff classifications involved on things coming from Canada. And at the time, rhubarb was either subject to a 35% duty as fruits in their natural state or a 50% duty if they were ruled to be vegetables. So obviously, the importers wanted them to be ruled as fruits. So they obviously did some testing. The rhubarb in question was pulled from the ground. The tops were cut off and the roots were left in the ground. Typically eaten as a pie or stewed as a dessert, testimony before the court indicated that it was never eaten as a side dish with poultry. But then a customs representative gave conflicting testimony, stating he was more likely to eat rhubarb with his meal than as a dessert. They found the one weird customs official who eats rhubarb as a vegetable.
I think he was lying. I think that guy was lying on the stand.
I think so. Yeah. The court then went to the dictionary and they were, you know, they looked at the definition of vegetable and a fruit. Rhubarb is specifically described as, in an encyclopedia, as a leaf stalk used for sauces and pies. One definition of fruit says that fruit is the fleshy and juicy product of some plant, and fleshy and juicy does not describe rhubarb in its natural form. And another definition noted that the term fruit is occasionally applied to certain other vegetable structures of pronounced flavour eaten as a sauce or dessert, as the stalks of rhubarb. So that definition in an encyclopedia was probably the one that they were able to lean on to come up with their decision. The Supreme Court had already ruled in the 1890s that tomatoes are a vegetable for tariff purposes. So they had a track record for going against, you know, certain dictionary definitions and so on.
Is this before or after the Jaffa cake fiasco?
Oh, Jaffa cakes are a vegetable, you're right.
Before. Yeah. I think they're a herb. Actually, I think Jaffa cakes generally perceived to be a herb. I did look up large vegetables, and of course the one I wanted to find out was the world's heaviest eggplant or aubergine. The average weight of an eggplant is about 5 ounces. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, how heavy is the world's heaviest eggplant?
5 kilos.
A bit less than that. Like 16 kilos.
Yeah, no, you've overestimated by a bit. 3 kilos, 6 pounds, 11 ounces. In the UK in 2018, the heaviest vegetable of all time is a pumpkin.
Yes.
Weighing in at over 2,600 pounds, a little bit lighter than a Mini Cooper.
Yeah.
And a family of three can live in it in South London for just £450,000.
Except if you were paying attention earlier on, we learned that, of course, the pumpkin isn't a vegetable, it's a fruit. No. So the largest... So the heaviest vegetable of all time is actually a cabbage weighing in at just 125 pounds, much lighter. But for my world's worst vegetable, I've gone for a turnip.
Mm-hmm.
And one specific turnip. Let me take you to 1932, the years of Prohibition, and the Coast Guard cutter Daphne, which was combating run-runners on the in the North Atlantic seas. And while on patrol, on Wednesday, June 15th, 1932, the 165-foot B-class cutter Daphne came across a Newfoundland-registered vessel, the Gonif, 80 miles east of New York. And they suspected that the Gonif was smuggling contraband. And so they did the usual tactic of calling them to, you know, heave, stand by, so the cutter could come close and conduct an inspection. And things take a bit of a turn here. According to the people on board the Gonif, the Daphne's gun crew and food service personnel mustered on deck, and the Coast Guardsmen began, I don't know why they didn't have weapons, like normal weapons, they just started throwing paint and eggs and potatoes and other produce at the Gonif before then spraying them with a high pressure fire hose, which led the people on board the Gonif to start throwing jars of molasses back at the Daphne. Trust the Canadians to have some syrup on board.
Yeah,
complete nautical food spy. Yeah. Obviously, jars of molasses on the wooden deck of this cutter meant there was a lot of sticky floorboards underneath them. And at this point, one Coast Guard officer on board the Daphne was knocked out when he was hit on the head with a turnip. Incapacitating him.
I mean, that has escalated hilariously.
It goes further. The crew on the Daphne, furious at what had been done to their officer, began shoving nuts and bolts into their potatoes to throw back, like when kids put stones into snowballs.
Kids did that?
Yeah. I mean, vicious kids. The sort of kids you wouldn't want to have snowball fights with. But it's like, it's all fun and games until someone knocks out the officer with a turnip and then things get really nasty.
Okay, so many questions. But also the jars of molasses. Surely that would be harder than a turnip.
You'd have thought, but maybe they'd run out of the molasses at that point, or it was a case of all hands on whatever they could get their hands on.
So I imagine they were throwing the actual molasses.
There's a hole in this tactic, they say, staring at their sticky palms. The Gonif broke free and began to escape, and the Daphne chased them, rammed it in the stern, and the Gonif had to abort what was in fact a running mission that it was conducting. And the Canadian government was obviously quite unhappy about this because, you know, the Coast Guard had treated its ship in a particularly rough manner. The Canadian government, that is. The Canadian government were very displeased at the treatment of its ships. They sent a formal protest to the Coast Guard saying that, you know, was more than 50 miles out of off coast. You know, it was international waters, basically, as far as they're concerned. And there are always two sides to this. Captain Randolph Ridgely, who was the senior officer at Coast Guard District 1, who read the report, stated that the ramming of the runner was due to its laying down a smoke screen, dousing lights, and zigzagging to elude interdiction. So, you know, there were some signs that maybe they were doing something illegal in the first place. And the crew of the Daphne did indeed stop it reaching US soil, so it did its job, but not without one of its officers being felled by a rogue turnip. A little footnote to all of this is that at the end of Prohibition, Daphne was transferred to the West Coast, and it was one of the ships that escorted Al Capone's high security barge to Alcatraz.
Wow.
When he was being transferred to that prison.
That is tremendous. I don't know, I was hoping for some sort of an Al Capone molasses-based escape attempt.
Yeah, well, of course Al Capone got caught for having sticky fingers rather than any of his gangster material. Our candidates this week for the world's worst vegetable are Ben's suggestion of the unnamed Jewish hoarded vegetable which led to so much anti-Semitism in Russia.
Can I point out a tiny bit further research has discovered that this vegetable was also hairy.
A hairy vegetable that the Jews wouldn't give to everybody, according to anti-Semites in Russia, and which could cure drunkenness.
I mean, that was the most elaborate chat-up line I've ever used. I've got a hairy vegetable yeah. that will cure your drunkenness, but I'm not giving it to you.
Robin's suggestion of the king of vegetables being dethroned, the carrot, which turned your skin orange, thinks it was better than us because of its time fighting in the war. Okay, boomer. And which Robin could be killed by, let's be fair. And my suggestion of one specific turnip in the battle between the Daphne and the Gonif off the coast of America in 1932. Jack, how do you separate all of this?
I mean, you've got broad range of just all carrots, a specific turnip, or the anti-Semitic mystery vegetable.
a masterly summation, if I may say, my lord.
I just like with the turnip, it starts, well, it's part of this massive nautical food fight, which in fairness, it probably annoyed them enough that they then decided to, they're going to stop the food fight and just ram this boat, which eventually stopped them.
I like that detail that they thought food fight first, ramming later was a valid tactic.
Yeah, personally, I'm a carrot fan. Carrot cake is amazing. So,
I'm sorry, Robin. Robin, sometimes in the show, you got to play the man, not the ball.
Yeah. What would you replace carrots in a carrot cake with? You can't really use a sweet potato in that.
Courgette.
Oh, courgette cake is horrible,
no,
though. It's so
is
wet.
Not. You are not draining your courgette. Or just take the carrot out of the cake and have a cake without vegetables in it. Because cake's not supposed to have vegetables. It's cake. Or beetroot. Beetroot works really well as well.
Yeah, beetroot cake. Are you? I mean, listen.
Red velvet cake. You can make it with beetroot.
I knew you were going to say that.
It works as a really good natural pink coloring in food.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And it has a slightly sweet flavor. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, beetroot, 100%. And beets come in all different colors, too.
I mean, personally, I would have said peppers because they are just wrong in every format.
You'll be glad to know they're a fruit and they're part of the belladonna family.
Another fruit I can't stand. Great to being a vegetarian.
Yeah.
So I guess that just leaves us with the mythical, hairy, anti-Semitic, inducing vegetable that even has no name. It's just that one. I think that's going to be the winner for me. The source of anti-Semitism in Russia.
I'm so competitive and I am so
Robin
angry.
Is so furious.
Yeah, I know, like Robin is ready to go. Do you know what? Carrots are actually Islamophobic. What are you going to do about that?
Yeah, exactly. And also, I lost to something without a name. I lost to something that doesn't exist.
That makes it even more.
Welcome to this show.
If it had a name and actually exist, it would be, I don't know, worse than a carrot. But it doesn't.
It is. Now, like obviously, quite a common, quite a regular common denominator on this show is, do we go with the thing that exists or the thing that doesn't exist? And by not existing, that makes it more potent on this show. It's like the opposite of that argument for God by Thomas Aquinas of, well, a perfect thing has to exist, so God exists. So, sorry that you fell for that. More importantly, listeners, feel free to get involved in our Discord or on social media and suggest a possible name for the anti-Semitic, hairy, Russian vegetable. Play nicely. Try not to make it a racist suggestion.
Yeah. He's saying that if an anti-Semitic, hairy vegetable didn't exist, it would be necessary for God to invent it, Ben.
Yeah, it definitely exists in the Apocrypha.
Yeah. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the world's best news of the week and good news for anybody who owns Lego. The market for secondhand Lego has risen at a better rate annually than stocks, bonds, stamps, art, and wine. Apparently, investing in Lego is now more lucrative than gold. It's risen in value, the secondhand market, by 11% annually, better than any of those things I just mentioned. Researchers at the Higher School of Economics in Russia said there could be lucrative gains to be made from investing in more unusual goods, whose purchase might seem less serious, such as Lego sets, Barbie dolls, superhero minifigures, model cars, and trains. People think of investments as, you know, jewellery or artworks and so on, but obviously collectibles is a more recent thing. It's, you know, it's within the last 100 years become a thing rather than in the last millennia or so. But the most expensive sets include the Millennium Falcon, the Death Star 2, and the Imperial Star Destroyer from Star Wars, as well as the Taj Mahal. The study looked at the prices of 2,232 LEGO sets from 1987 to 2015, and factors like limited production runs, special editions, and scarcity and so on have significantly boosted prices. Only sales of the new unopened sets were selected. So yeah, if you're... I mean, I'm sitting in a room with two unopened sets of Millennium Falcons beside me, which are too large to put into our flat, but my husband has bought them anyway, so that's my pension plan right off screen. And last month, by the way, LEGO, which is the world's largest toy maker, awarded its 20,000 staff 3 extra days holiday and special bonuses because of a bumper year of revenue and profits, with sales soaring during the pandemic, which... When you read about the sort of boost in sales for various different things during lockdown, LEGO is one of those corporations I kind of don't mind. And in a world where everything else seems to be going to shit, kind of not minding a corporate bonus system for one company feels like a win. Before we go, Robin, where can people find out more about you and your work?
So I am on Instagram and Twitter at Robin H. Perkins, and it's Robin with a Y. I also have an online show every Sunday called Comedy for the Curious, which is a comedy panel show that combines stand-up comedy, science comedy, and a silly game. So we have a different topic every week, and that is at Comedy for the Curious on Instagram. But also those are websites as well, robinperkins.com and comedyforthecurious.com. And that is it.
Nice. Lovely. And Jack, if people want to find out about you, where can they go if you want to share such information?
Nowhere. I don't really use the social media a lot, if honest.
Very good. In which case, hanging around in Berlin, off at the bee somewhere.
Hanging around, yeah. Eating carrot cake, doing what you do, whatever.
Drinking wine and making drugs. You know, standard.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we're all off to the Octagon to set Robin into a cage match with Peter Rabbit. Thank you for listening to Worstwood Forward. Goodbye.
Bye.